Welcome to Designed for More, brought to you by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Join Dr. Timothy Jennings, a renowned expert in psychiatry, neuroscience, and spiritual well-being, as he explores the connections between mind, body, spirit, and relationships.
Welcome to Designed for More, sponsored by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. I'm Dr. Tim Jennings, joined today by Danielle Rome, one of our therapists, and Dr. Carl Benzio, our chief psychiatric officer and co-founder of Honey Lake Clinic. And today we're going to be talking about understanding and overcoming addictions, a faith and science approach. And before we even got this show, I want to say on the air, but before we started recording the program, we were having a discussion. Well, what is an addiction? What is an addiction? And some people, I've heard many people online sometimes say, everybody's got an addiction. I don't take that view. My definition of an addiction is a compulsive engagement in behaviors that bring short-term reward, but long-term destruction. Not everybody has that. Not everybody is compulsively engaging in behaviors that are simply bringing reward while simultaneously destroying them. But I understand that Dr. Benzio has a different definition. So what's your definition of an addiction?
Well, my simple definition would be whenever somebody has a behavior that they're trying to stop, but they're having trouble, they're having difficulty stopping it, even though there's consequences that would tell them, hey, we need to stop this. They don't want the consequences, but they're trying to stop, but they're having difficulty stopping that behavior. From a theological standpoint, a refinement of that is whenever people pursue something other than God in a habitual pattern or repetitive way to get their needs met. So looking at God is really the provider for our needs, but we often pursue a bunch of other things to get our needs met in a repetitive, habitual, or patterned way. It wouldn't be just something that somebody goes one time to try this particular avenue to get their needs met, but something that they're doing in a repetitive, habitual, or patterned way to get their needs met that's leaving God out of that provision equation.
Yeah, I find that a very murky and ill-defined description that could fit addictions, but I can already start thinking of exceptions that don't fit that. So I don't know. I like to articulate and operate in a landscape where people can go, yes, I get that. And that seemed to be very amorphous. And so is what I said amorphous? Is what I said hard to get your mind around? A compulsive engagement behavior that rewards you in the short term, but destroys or harms you in the long term. Is that hard to comprehend or get?
It's not hard to comprehend, but those are activities that a person is pursuing other than God to get various needs met.
Yeah,
needs that, you know, they have inside, that whether they be real needs or perceived needs, that they're pursuing something other than God that's not bringing them the health that they need. This brings them some kind of consequence, but they have a patterned, repetitive, or compulsive way of pursuing those particular objects. Now, oftentimes we look at substances as, you know, or chemicals as the primary addiction element that we talk about when we talk about addictions, whether it's alcohol or cigarettes or marijuana, psychedelics, cocaine. But most people have the more common addictions are the behavioral addictions, whether it's addiction to power, control, the need for approval, people pleasing. And so those are those amorphous.
Well, yeah. So yes, the chemical ones are the more common ones, but the definition I gave fits your porn addiction, your gambling addiction, your shopping addiction. And again, the thing is the compulsive engagement that is for that reward, but it actually is harming at the same time. Mm-hmm. There are lots of unhealthy things people do, and they may do them chronically, but they may not be an addiction.
I think some of
them. For instance, I know people that I was in the military with who have a chronic habit of using curse words in their sentences. And this is where they grew up. This is how they learned to speak. It's not Christ-like in any way, but it's not done compulsively. And it's not done as a way to bring them a reward and you get some type of a altered feeling state or something out of.
Mm-hmm.
It's not adaptive, but it's a bad habit.
Does it cause them a lot of consequences?
Irrespective, it's not an addiction. They're not even really noticing it unless somebody else points it out because that's the language they've been learned to speak.
I think if it had a lot of consequences and then they were trying to make efforts to stop it but had trouble stopping it, I think then they might have to look at, well, what's underlying that might be more of a compulsive pattern or habitual pattern that they're getting some other needs met through that particular activity that they're having so much trouble stopping it.
Yeah, I'm just not going to go along with that definition.
Yeah, you don't have to.
Yeah. No. All right. So, but let's talk about the addictions that I think people recognize. They're engaged in these compulsive behaviors that are rewarding them in some way and is harming them in the long term.
I think for me, an important way to look at addictions is seeing them in stages. So oftentimes there's the first one is experimental, where a person just uses a substance just because it's there. They didn't have any real plans. They didn't have any agenda for it. It was there. It was available. Oh, people have talked about this or have tried it. I've seen people use it. Let me try it and see. Experimental. For some, they stop at that point. For some people.
But then was that an addiction?
No, not an addiction.
Okay, so they're not. They don't have an addiction to it yet. They're just experimenting.
Just experiment. Okay. Second stage usually is recreational, where now they're starting to use it with, instead of just experimenting, that usually they're not using it on their by themselves in isolation. It's usually at a party, some peers, older brother, whatever is using it. So they're using it sort of recreationally, just sort of as something to do, just like any other recreational activity. So that, again, isn't an addiction yet. Then there becomes the circumstantial stage or circumstantial use, where they start to use it because they think as it relates to a particular circumstance that it's going to remedy or help or give them some benefit in that circumstance. So a person is anxious about going to a high school party, afraid to talk to somebody of the opposite sex. So they have drink some alcohol to be able to reduce some of their inhibitions, to be able to allow them to be more fluent, less anxious at a particular party.
And does it give them benefit, or they just think it gives them a benefit?
It might give them some benefit. It might reduce some of their fears and anxieties to allow them to be a little bit more fluid, but it doesn't give them the benefit that they're thinking that it gives them the process, and it starts to get a little bit more harmful. But that's a circumstantial use, whether it's studying for a test and needing to use a roommate's Adderall to study up, pull an all-nighter. Where it becomes dangerous is whenever they have that circumstantial use and they get tricked into thinking that, wow, that was beneficial for me. That really helped me get through that party or study for that test or cram for that exam or de-stress from the end of the day so I didn't hit my kids at night after that hard work day to be able to have a couple drinks after work or smoke some weed during the course of the day so I didn't get agitated at work and get into a fight at work. They start to get tricked in their mind thinking that, wow, that substance actually benefited me in that circumstance. So that's the dangerous, to me, the dangerous step of stage. Then it becomes more regular use where that circumstance not only is at a party, now I'm going to expand those circumstances to a whole bunch of other situations that chemical seems to give me some benefit for, but it's starting to get the consequences now. And so now that intensified use, and some people stop at each phase of these stages. So I'm not saying that you go from stage one all the way to stage six. Anytime along the way, you can stop. But sort of the dangerous progression is that experimental, recreational, circumstantial, regular. Then comes the intensified use. And the intensified use is where usually the consequences start piling up that we see in the DSM. Here's the 11 consequences or the situations that we see. And the person starts to have that, boy, it's starting to be a lot harder for me just to stop on my own. And then that compulsive use is that sixth stage where unless you're put in a supervised situation or supervised environment under their own power, they seem to really have a hard time just stopping that on their own.
So when I look at the landscape of addiction, what you just described, if we look at that like a pie chart, is a wedge in the pie chart. There's that describes a serious number of people who have addictions, what you just described.
Mm-hmm.
Does that describe the person who, you know, got in the car wreck and got put on opiates by their prescriber and then had some, like, they got the pain benefit, but they had something else they never had before. And then by the time the wound is healed, they're overusing these meds. It didn't necessarily fit that addiction. Or does it fit?
Well, it can. Okay, because there's the circumstance that they're using that for. Then they're starting to use that opioid for other circumstances when they just don't, when they feel off, when they feel sad.
No, but I'm saying it changed something in them. They took it and it changed because they have a genetic vulnerability. And the data shows people with certain genes, they get exposed to opiates. They have a marked, multiple standard deviations higher stimulation in their reward circuitry than somebody without those genes. And so they experience something they've never experienced before. And it's just, you know, neurochemical for them, and then they become addicted to it. That's a different, seems to me a different wedge than what you described. And I'm not saying what you described is wrong. I'm just wondering if that's the entire pie.
Yeah, I would say that that person that has that genetic predisposition, there's still some psycho-spiritual elements that play into that, both that we're going to bring in as far as remediation, but also just in that process that also made that that landscape or that soil fertile for that particular variation to interact with the opioid with this psycho-spiritual background that allowed them to get more trapped into that circumstantial and regular use as it intensified. Even though consequences started to happen, the genetics just don't define.
In other words, they weren't going out looking.
Free will in a process.
They didn't go through that process of experimental use and recreational. They got it clinically.
They got dumped into circumstantial. Yeah, so here's the circumstance. I'm using this thing. But because of some other psycho-spiritual element,
it transitioned
from circumstantial to regular use as they started to expand some of the circumstances. So the genetics didn't take away their free will in the process. It maybe weighted it
and weighted the pleasure and the benefits
a little bit higher because of that dopamine pathway in the mesolimbic system that we can talk about in the reward pathway.
So would you say for the chemical addictions that there has to be, or there as evidence of a strong genetic vulnerability, that not everybody is vulnerable to the same degree in related to chemical addiction?
I would say some people have a genetic vulnerability that's higher than other people, but I don't think you need a genetic vulnerability to be able to be trapped in an addiction process.
Yeah, I would agree with that too. Yeah.
I mean, because you can have biological changes in your brain that are induced by genetics, but are also induced by trauma, loss, hurt, maladaptive relationships, and other things that have altered your brain chemistry to make that fertile ground for addictive processes to occur, and reward pathways, and that dopamine drip and that dopamine surge, and all those things are affected by genes, but also by our experiences in life.
Do you see neurobiological differences between chemical addictions? And I don't mean the withdrawal elements and the tolerance elements. I mean the reward reinforcing elements. So let's just talk about the reward reinforcing elements that get people trapped in the pursuit of this over and over again. Do you see that reward reinforcing aspect of the chemical addictions different than the behavioral addictions like gambling and pornography? Or do you see that those addictions are actually, operating on the same neural platforms of the reward reinforcing circuits?
Pretty similar platforms. You know, that's why whenever we have people that are child molesters and child abusers that are in jail, we see circuits of the brain, even whenever they imagine the crimes that they committed, we see those same sort of reward pathways light up in those processes. So there's a lot of similarities to it. I think whenever you have a chemical as well, not only do you have the sort of the psychological aspects, but you have the chemicals hitting the dopamine reward pathway. So there's sort of an accentuated whenever you have a substance that's also a contributor to that firing of the reward pathways, as well as the thought process that also is firing those pathways.
Okay. Daniel, do you have a question at all? No? Okay.
Yeah, I'm just processing what you guys are saying, but I do really want to highlight and like what you said a few minutes ago about these things not taking away free will. Because I think a lot of people can believe the lie that they're just permanently trapped and they can kind of give up when they're in the middle of these patterns. And so I think it's important that we highlight that people still have, and sometimes you need support from community. You need other people to help intervene, right? But I think it's important for our listeners to hear that there is free will and capacity to end.
So I wasn't going to go there yet, but since you brought it up, it's timely. Let's talk about that aspect of free will and addiction. And let's talk about the person who's already, well, you give six stages, already at the sixth stage. We won't talk about the process of how they got there and the free will there. So they're addicted. They've, and let's talk about the person who acknowledges they're addicted. Okay. Mm-hmm. So they know they have an addiction, and they've been fighting it, but they've failed over and over, and they keep relapsing back, and they've experienced negative consequence. And they maybe have this mindset that they're trapped. They're powerless. They're helpless. But what's the secret to the action of the will? If they actually have free will, you're not suggesting to that addict that they're just freely choosing to do this, are you? It's just, you're just freely choosing to do this to yourself. That's not what you don't mean that. And neither one of you means that, do you? No. So, but somebody could hear that potentially. So I said that kind of sarcastically to throw that out.
Yeah.
Because you're not suggesting they freely, willfully just go keep destroying themselves like this. That's absolutely part of the addiction or a trap. Yes. But they still have free will. So what's the secret for this person of what they need to do with their free will to get them out of that circle?
Can you recognize the limitations of where they're at and get help?
What does that mean? What do they have to do with? They have to do something with their will.
Yeah, for me, it's understanding the truth. Like Romans 7, you know, Paul's, I call it the addict's lament sometimes, where, you know, the good things I want to do, I don't do. The bad things I don't want to do, I do. Woe be me. It's the flesh and the spirit that war within me. Who's going to win? Wretched man that I am, blah, blah, blah. And to me, a lot of times as I read that, I think of that unconscious space that we have, that internal part of who we are that has some awareness if we bring it into through self-reflection and self-awareness, bring some of that unconscious stuff out. But we all have some illogical information inside of us that makes logical options look illogical and makes illogical options look logical. And so trying to take every thought captive to the obedience of Christ as we look and examine what's going on in our unconscious space to purge that misinformation. So me, when I was struggling with my addiction with alcohol and pornography and power and control, there was some misinformation in there that made those illogical options look really logical to me in the moment. Whenever I sat back in the morning, it's like, boy, I'm not going to do that today. But whenever I was caught up in the moment, then at the Last Supper, and Jesus tells Peter, you're going to deny me three times. He's like, I'd never do that. But then a few hours later in the courtyard, he totally chokes and he denies him. It's not that he doesn't know what's right. It's just that there's stuff in his unconscious space that are making the illogical option look logical and the logical look illogical. So trying to help the individual understand, hey, there's some misinformation, there's consequence, there's something that you're gaining from this that you can gain in a whole bunch of other more beneficial, healthier ways for you. Let's understand the truth of what you're doing, what you believe in, what's sort of fueling all this in the process of your need for whatever this gain that you're getting from this particular either behavior or chemical. And let's navigate that process. And usually a person needs to get in a safe place where they can be removed from that object as it continues to fuel their reward pathways in a pathological way. We need to start to dim those and help them understand, well, how do they get reward from the things that God has given us to be a healthy dopamine drip in our reward pathway, as opposed to pursuing the dysfunctional ones that, yeah, they give us a little bit of dopamine, but boy, they cause a whole bunch of other catastrophic cascades in our neurocircuitry.
So did that answer the question? Not that you said anything I disagree with, because I don't. But did that answer the question for that person who's caught up in their addiction and they keep failing and feels like they're trapped? And what do they do with their will? What I heard you say in succinct is they have some misinformation or distortion in their thinking that is trapping them, and so to have some truth come to bear that could help them. But with the truth, comprehension, epiphany, awareness doesn't change anything. It's what you do with it.
Yeah,
it does make it.
It's practice. You have to understand what it is, and then how are we going to put it into play? You know, decision after decision after decision.
Well, that's the will.
Rewire.
The will is not the comprehension. The will is the decision. The decision maker. The choices. Mm-hmm. That's the will. And so we're not suggesting that while they still have free will, we're not suggesting that it's simply on their own a willpower fight. We're not suggesting that either, are we? They're not choosing to do this, but they're also not. We're not suggesting, well, they're capable if they just pull the bootstraps with enough willpower, they can get over this. We're not suggesting that either, are we?
That'd be pretty rare.
Correct.
Yeah, no, we're not. No, in fact, yeah. No. But the will is involved, and the will is involved in, my understanding, is ultimately, what's the first step of the 12 steps? There's a decision on that first step, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
That's a choice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm powerless.
They have to acknowledge.
Yeah.
You have to acknowledge. They have to be truthful. That's the truth. Mm-hmm. And so they have to acknowledge that they're, and then that, and that one immediately leads pretty much one and two kind of go like this, right? Immediately leads to, this is the big key, the second step. There's a power higher than me that restores me sanity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's what you do with the will, is you admit your powers and you surrender yourself to your higher power and then begin making choices to align with your higher power and his directives for your life. There's a whole journey and a process in that. But while the person can't break the bubble themselves, can any addict choose to turn their will over to the Lord?
Yeah.
They can make that choice, can't they?
Yeah. So whenever I was, listeners might not know, but I was addicted to alcohol and ended up in jail for 6 counts of aggravated assault felony charges. And it was in jail that God spoke to me and said, Carl, you made me your savior when you were a little kid, which I did. I, you know, who wants to burn in hell forever? I answered many an altar call as a kid. But you never made me the Lord of your life. So you're talking about that, you know, who is, I'm not the one who's have power over my life. It's him. If you make me the Lord of your life, I'm going to teach you things about decision-making, which was what my passion was. I'll teach you things about decision-making that will renew your mind, transform your life, and help you renew and transform other people's lives as well. And it was that realization that when I heard Lord, I heard authority. When I heard authority, I heard author. When I heard author, I realized that I had thought that I was the one who was qualified to write the How Does Carl Get the Most Out of Life instruction manual. And when I heard, you know, Lord, authority, author, I realized that while he's written the how-to book, the instruction manual, the B-I-B-L-E, as to how to get the most out of life, because he's the designer and he designed my mind and he designed these principles into it for me to maximize, you know, the abundant life that he's gifted me and called me to live. And that it was that epiphany of, you know, I'm powerless. I need to make him the Lord of my life. And I need to get off the throne because I kept on thinking that I was the one who should be on the throne.
And so back to the addict then. Isn't it the addicts, they say, trapped? Isn't it that they are at some level still fighting the battle on their own?
Mm-hmm.
They're fighting, I can handle this. And it's part of the, you know, the denial. Ah, I could do it. I'm fine. I can get over this. Just one won't matter. You know, all the things. But isn't it that they haven't actually, with their free will, freely chosen to acknowledge they can't do it on their own.
Yep.
And that there is a power that can.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but maybe this goes to why some addicts struggle is because the view of God they have is one that is so untrustworthy, no one would ever want to turn their life over to them. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's pictures of God out there that is authoritarian, abusive. He's a punitive being, and they've messed up. Why do I want to go to him? He's only going to punish me and tell me how bad I am. Mm-hmm. I've known addicts that have this view of God. I mean, they feel condemned, and they feel he's going to just condemn them worse.
And a lot of people's view of authority figures is something like that. You know, we sort of grow up in situations, and at least for me, I came to realize, and a lot of patients, that, well, when other people are in power, I get hurt a lot. But when I'm in power, when I have control, I get hurt a lot less. So whenever it comes time to,
but that's ultimately not true, is it?
No, it's not true at all.
Yeah.
But when it comes time to thinking of authority figures in relationship with God, well, we want to give him the power. But if we've had these other relationships, sort of that conditioned response of, well, relationship, I want to be in power. I want to be in control because I'll get hurt a lot less. And while I was a psychiatrist, a lot of other people are hurt a lot less too. I'm pretty good at what I do. So I should have then all the power. So I transitioned from alcohol to power as sort of a process addiction. And so I learned how to process that through the, you know, at times. But I think that that's that situation that the, you know, people who are struggling with these compulsive behaviors, these pattern, repetitive, habitual activities, it's hard for them to give up. Well, that's control because they think that, well, I'm just going to get hurt more, which then drives them to drink or to use their substance because, you know, they want to escape comfort, peace, whatever, to distract them from the pain that they have. And now they're going to have more pain because, well, I'm going to have to give up to this person and this person is going to control me and I'm going to get hurt again.
So what I wanted, well said, what I wanted people to recognize that the link here where I'm going is that they have the power to make a decision to turn, to recognize their own inability, their helplessness, and to turn their life over to a higher power. But if they have a view of a higher power as your authoritarian rule, then that's an obstacle.
Mm-hmm.
And thus that view has to change for them to really do it. And this is one of the purposes functionally of the 12-step programs, that when a person goes to a 12-step program, if they run like they're supposed to, the person will experience something that disavows them of that bias or fear. They will say, hey, I'm Joe. I'm an alcoholic. and they will hear back, welcome, Joe. Mm-hmm. They will not hear condemnation. They will experientially be disabused of this idea that if people know I have an addiction, I'll be condemned, I'll be punished. And then that will, they will then hear a testimony and experience from people who know a God who is actually not in the condemning business, but in the saving business. And that is why the 12-step programs are so important, because most of these people don't have that spiritual connection themselves. And they are likely have a distorted view of fear of condemnation and punishment. And the program allows them to actually experientially disabuse themselves of that bias and realize in the statement of welcome, Joe, it's understood in the moment, you, Joe, are welcomed.
Yeah.
Your alcoholism is not.
Well,
and we want to free you of that. And that's its whole program, is that you are welcomed and we see you struggling with the problem that's killing you. And we want to get that disease out of you, if you will, and heal you. And that shifts the model from a behavioral model and behavioral modification of bad stuff, you know, punishment, good stuff, reward, to a person who is struggling in a injurious cycle.
An internal healing.
And a healing model, yeah.
And so for me, the opposite of addiction is belonging. So, you know, we're made for relationship. We're built for relationship with God, built for relationship with others. We don't do good in isolation, but whenever a person has trouble figuring out who they belong to or where they belong or with that connection and with the community, they need to have a relationship with something. So now they develop a relationship with a chemical, with a substance, with a pattern behavior. So that becomes their buddy. That becomes their go-to. That becomes their, you know, intimate relationship, which then further isolates them, which in that isolation, they, you know, are drawn more to that particular substance or that behavior. And I think that's the wonderful thing about ideally church and, you know, support group meetings like AA and NA and CA and those kind of things, is there's a sense of belonging.
So what
do we see you, we hear you, we care for you, you belong.
But the addiction doesn't. There's also, while we belong, there's not acceptance of the ongoing dysfunction.
There's not condonement.
There's not condonement, yes. So what do you say to those who take the position, well, I have an addiction, and addiction is a disease? And nobody chooses disease. I don't have any free will here. I don't have any choice in this. Nobody chooses disease. You just have a disease if you have a disease. What do you say to that?
I'd say there are some physiological issues with your brain and your structure, your reward chemistry and pathways, and that's a disease. Your physiology has been disrupted. So, but even though you have a disease, doesn't mean you don't have free will and you don't have decisions and options to be able to make. Just like whenever a person, you know, chooses to continue to eat too much and they develop type 2 diabetes, well, they still have choices of what they can do, but that doesn't mean they don't have diabetes anymore. They still have diabetes, but there's choices they can do to remediate, to lessen the impact of it. Maybe if they catch it early enough, to reverse it and not have insulin or hypoglycemic medications that they're going to need in the process. So the two aren't mutually exclusive.
Yeah, and so because sometimes, and as you hear that as a form of denial.
Yeah.
Okay, it's not my fault.
I want to absolve myself from responsibility.
Exactly. Isn't that part of an addict's journey, to avoid the guilt or responsibility? Now, is there a place for guilt in addiction? Or is it just, for instance, a diabetic typically doesn't feel guilty for their diabetes, even if they've overeaten, they generally don't. It's a disease. But is there a place for addictions for the addict to have guilt, or is guilt inappropriate?
Well, I think, just going back to the other analogy that you were mentioning, just whenever we are the king, mm-hmm. right, and we're on the throne, we usually don't feel responsible for things. We sort of abdicate responsibility. We just want the perks of kingship, and I want to be Lord, and I want to, you know, blame other people or blame the servants or the mm-hmm. servants for all the mm-hmm. problems that are happening in the kingdom, kind of thing. You know, as far as guilt, yeah, sure, there's certainly things that we do wrong, you know, in our addictive process. You know, pursuing something other than God and a habitual pattern of behavior way to meet our needs is, you know, ignoring our relationship with God and, you know, working outside the bounds of that relationship. There's certainly harm that I've did to many people through that process of my addiction that I had guilt feelings about and need to make remediation for in that process.
So my approach to a lot of the guilt questions are, you don't have to necessarily feel guilty. In fact, I don't think you need to feel guilty for having the condition. But you do need to feel guilty for refusing to participate in the remedy.
Yeah, the decisions you need to make, right?
You either
make a good decision or a bad decision.
You have a condition, you don't need to feel guilty for it. But if you refuse remedy that's offered for free that'll help you heal and overcome, you can feel guilty for rejecting that, whatever it is, the diabetic who refuses insulin. Okay, you don't have to feel guilty for having diabetes, but if you refuse the insulin and have a bad, you can feel guilty for that when it was offered for free, even. And the healing that God offers is a free remedy that He's provided, it free for us, high cost for Him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I think some of that, in the 12-step process, there's that, how to forgive others and how to be able to ask for forgiveness, right? And then how to be able to forgive yourself in that process. So those are some of those key elements of that 12-step
I know you've
process.
Done a lot of work on the, and you started out with this, on the spiritual connections to addictions. Can you articulate for our audience, what do you see as the spiritual roots of addiction? What are the spiritual deficits and or problem that leads to addictions?
Yeah, I think, pride is a big one. Whenever we think that we know everything, that we can do everything, that we have power over everything, that we don't need God in the process to supply our needs, that I can supply my own needs for whatever whatever's going on, whether the positive needs that I have or the dysfunctional needs that I have. There's another element.
There's something deeper than that. I'm not disagreeing those two, but those defenses to something even deeper, like the narcissistic defense, the pride and arrogant defense. Mm-hmm. Is there something deeper in the soul that is somebody's trying to medicate with their addiction?
Well, so in trying to figure out, well, what are those desires? How do we go about getting those desires met and having that wanting to take shortcuts a lot of time and trying to find solutions or meet those needs. And those shortcuts usually lead to destruction in the process. So that sort of fuels a, lack of identity, insecurity, and impotence in being able to really meet our needs. But yet it's hard for us to admit that. So we sort of either point our fingers or just are in denial that we're not meeting that. And so we look for more quick fixes or easy solutions for that process. But there's that broken, fractured, not whole view of ourself that we have, sort of a distorted view or an exalted view blended with an insecure view at the same time, that we're battling to try to mediate, but we're not really looking at the right place for, well, this is where healing occurs, or this is where identity, or this is where purpose, or this is where sanity, or just order and just understanding, what comes first, what comes second, and then how to not just intellectually engage with that, but then what does that look like on a daily commitment and trusting those truths and those principles? So I that guides all my decisions through the day, not just, oh, I had that epiphany on Sunday, but then I'm just going to lead my life, the old way on Monday through Saturday. That's just going to be a destructive process.
So deep inside a person who doesn't know the Lord, wouldn't we say people have described this, I think, in a metaphor. I don't think it's literal, a God hole or something. Mm-hmm. Okay. But there is a longing. Mm-hmm. There is an uneasiness, a restlessness. If you look at the Genesis account, they ran and hid because they were afraid. A certain insecurity. Mm-hmm. There's guilt, shame. There's some inadequacy, some fear of intimacy. People see me for how I think I am on the real inside, that I might not be loved or valued. I mean, do you think this is a human experience that most struggle with? They don't know the Lord inside?
I think even people that know the Lord struggle with that, but certainly people that don't know the Lord, that's what I was saying. We're built for relationship, but yet because of sort of Satan's attacks in this world, we get burned in relationships a lot. So there's a lot of insecurity and misinterpretations about what happened in those relationships and what is the information I've stored inside about those relationships that set us up for a lot of confusion, disorientation, and lack of efficacy in being able to interact in relationships.
So where I'm going with this is my experience of doing this for many, many decades now is that almost all of my patients in some form or fashion say that what they want is they want to be happy. In some form or fashion. I may not use that word, but that's they want to be happy. Yeah. And as I've looked at this over the course of my career, I've discovered that happiness is a byproduct. You can't get it by going after it. It's a byproduct of healthiness. And healthiness is in harmony with our creator and all the domains of life. Physical, when you're physically unwell, you're not happy. When you're psychologically unwell, nobody likes me, I can't do anything right, not happy. When you're spiritually unwell, guilt, shame, fears of the future and eternal destiny, like you mentioned hell before, and yet you're not happy. When you're relationally unwell and conflict with people, you're not. So happiness is a byproduct of healthiness, and people long for that. And I don't think Adam and Eve were happy after they took the fruit. I think they were hiding in fear. I think happiness was gone. But what happens is because people can't get happiness by going after it, they can only make choices to, where am I not healthy? And they can make healthy choices. And then if they move into health, they will get happier, okay? But what I find is that people who are longing for happiness but are not actually living healthy lives across the domains substitute pleasure-seeking for happiness. And you can do things that are momentarily pleasurable.
Your acute fix, yeah.
Okay? And whether it's shopping, whether it's a binge eating, whether it's the physical substances or pornography or whatever these addictive behaviors are, and sometimes relational addiction where you're going from partner to partner to partner to get that relational intimate fix of a buzz or a high, but it's not healthy. And in my experiences in doing this is what drives a lot of addiction. And pleasure seeking like this is almost always breaking the laws of health, which makes one less healthy, which actually makes one less happy, which then refuels the drive to make that unhappy feeling go away, so you push the addiction farther. I mean, do you think there's something in what I'm describing here?
Well, that's why I describe the sort of theological definitions of pursuing something other than God in a repetitive, habitual, or patterned way to get your needs met.
Yeah.
And those are the sort of internal relational needs and, you know, what really does give us fulfillment. Instead of looking to God and what God has provided to fulfill those needs, we start looking at other things because we're pretty impatient. We want immediacy, you know, to it. We want to feel good now, not sort of a long game where we don't have real good radar for the microscopic or the just below the radar spiritual, psychological, physiological, neurocircuitry well-being that we have whenever somebody smiles at us. Well, that's a nice thing. That's a little dopamine drip, but we're usually not appreciative of that little bit of dopamine that we got. We want something bigger. We want something more robust. We want something that's going to knock me off my feet. The kind of thing is a dopamine blast instead of just a chronic dopamine drip. So we pursue these more extravagant kind of things. And the sad thing, the way our reward circuitry works is that whenever we pursue those, the things like substances that give us that quick, more bolus of dopamine, as we do that a few times, our system realizes, well, we can't tolerate, you know, being on that high that long. So we downregulate our receptors so that we have less receptors, which to get that effect, then we need more of that substance. It starts to cause problems. And then we go, okay, we got to back off. So we back off, but now we have less receptors. So we don't get very much activity with good things or even with dysfunctional things. So now we are sad, we're anxious, we're frustrated, lonely.
Now I want to pick up on the receptor thing because we're starting to really outline an important point for our audience. And that is because of the downregulated receptors, metaphorically, this is what goes into the craving or desire. It's kind of like thirsting for people who don't have an addiction. You start thirsting and see the way God designed us, he designed these pleasure circuits where we experience pleasure to experience pleasure in doing healthy things. He designed that if you help your neighbor, that you feel good about that. It feels good. That if you actually have a healthy love relationship, that there's reward in that and it feels good. You eat a healthy meal and you enjoy the meal. He's designed for us to get pleasure in doing healthy things. But people who have pursued pleasure directly rather than just doing healthy things and experience pleasure from the healthy activity, exercise, whatever it might be, will then overstimulate the reward circuit, which the brain downregulates. Okay. And then you go into this craving for that fix, whatever the fix is, the relationship, the porn, whatever the fix is, you're craving it. And it's no longer, you're no longer driven by the desire to do something healthy again. Like if you were a healthy person doing routine exercise and it's 2 days since you exercise, you'll get a craving or desire to go do the healthy thing because you like your exercise and it's enjoyable to you. That's a positive reinforcement of healthy behavior. What happens is as you downregulate the reward circuitry, that doesn't actually reward anymore. And you upregulate your fear circuitry, and people begin, instead of going from the positive, they become fearful, like a person in thirst. I'm going to die of dehydration. I've got to get this. And it becomes a survival drive now. And this is where irrational thinking becomes in, destructive behaviors, all the plotting, where people become unreasonable.
Because lying, lame excuses.
Right. And so.
Blame shifting.
So if you were actually seriously dehydrated, let's say it's been 3 days and you've been, you know, in a hot summer in Florida and you haven't had water for 3 days and you're very dehydrated, and we put a bottle of water right in front of you and then try to have a conversation with you, will you be able to think about anything?
Very tough.
No, you are so
situated.
So urgent on that you can't process anything. And that's what's trying to have a rational decision, a conversation with people who are in withdrawal or in serious craving. Mm-hmm. You can't actually have a logical, they'll say anything. Just give me that water. Yeah, sure, fine. Take all my children. I don't care. Okay.
And that's what they're doing out in the street. Doing that.
Yes. And that's what, yes. And so. The point I'm making is there may be people listening of an addiction and they find those desperate moments. You need to get into a program where you can be medically stabilized, supported through the process of allowing your brain to get the foundations of recovery. When I say foundations, where you're past that urgent, desperate part. Mm-hmm.
That's a good word, foundations. Yeah.
Yeah. Because the true recovery is of neurobiology, if you're doing healthy stuff, is 12 to 24 months.
You didn't get this way overnight. You're not going to change overnight.
So but healthy patterns result in healthy outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so I want to tell somebody, don't be discouraged. Get into a good program where you can be detoxed. You can get the support you need. You can break that cycle, allow your brain to begin to repair. And you're not in that. And then you can actually engage those other drivers that you're talking about that maybe drove you into this cycle in the first place.
Yeah.
What do you think?
No, I agree. That's what we do here at Honey Lake Clinic. It's designed the program to really address those physiological, psychological, and spiritual elements, because they all need to work hand in hand together. But if that, when they reach that 6 days I was talking about, that compulsive stage where they're really, you know, that bottle is there and that's all they can fixate on is that bottle, they need to be in a safe environment that's going to protect them from diving into that unhealthy, contaminated, toxic bottle that allows their brain to slowly back off, and that regulation, those reward pathways, to start to normalize, and then to start to get some real enjoyment from the normal things that God has given us to excite us to hit that dopamine drip. So instead of it not registering at all, it registers nicely and you can become fulfilled in that. But that takes time. And oftentimes it takes that, you know, we talked about AA, of that supportive environment. I think that's another nice thing that we do at Honey Lake Clinic, is creating a community, caring, loving, low judgment, low critique community, to be able to come in and really bear your heart down to the foundation, so we can sort of see, well, what are the cracks and how do we fill them with Jesus cement and good psychological skills to start to have that good foundations to rebuild.
And I think that what you just said is absolutely key for long-term recovery. And I want the audience to know this. They've actually looked at 12-step programs that run in the traditional big book way.
Mm-hmm.
And the 12-step program with a traditional big book way is highly centered upon and dependent upon a higher power. And the higher power is ultimately Jesus Christ.
Yep.
And that's the traditional big book. And
it's not just another friend or my spouse or something of limited power.
No,
it's the ultimate power.
So those 12-step programs have been compared with what are humanistic 12-step programs. You take the 12 steps, but replace Jesus Christ with some other higher power, the force, some higher concept of good, a depersonalized something, or maybe a higher power is your best friend.
Yeah, just something with more power than you.
I remember a patient when I was in the military as a division psychiatrist in the U.S. Army, a young adolescent, late adolescent, who's his higher power was his skateboard. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, but they've compared that,
yeah,
and the outcomes of the ones devoid of Christ are significantly less, higher relapse rates. The power for recovery does not come from the person. The choice comes from the person. Mm-hmm. The power comes from the higher. That's a, I admit that I'm powerless, and I recognize a power higher than myself can restore me to sanity. The power comes from the higher power. And if that higher power is your skateboard, you're done. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. There's no power in a skateboard. Mm-hmm. And so that, I want people to understand that. And so if you get into a 12-step program, and my understanding also is there's been nothing that has been shown in any research to have better long-term recovery from addiction than a traditional 12-step program with Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Now we can augment with, you know, good chemical detox and therapy, but if you don't bring that piece in, it doesn't have long-term success.
It's that therapeutic community. Belonging is the opposite of addiction. So, you know, being able to belong to that community, and if that community is Christ-focused, then they're pointing you to who you ultimately belong to in the process. So they're sort of being a proxy for the ultimate belonging that we have.
Well, thank you for joining us. We only scratched the surface of addictions. I know we could do a lot more. Maybe we'll do another show in the future, but thanks for joining us today. If you have questions, send them into questions@designformore.net, questions@designformore.net. And if you'd like more resources, check our website, comeandreason.com. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on Designed for More, brought to you by Come and Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Also, don't forget to check out our other podcasts for more inspiring content.